I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Mo Amir joins me now. The host and producer of This Is Vancolor has gotten a lot of attention taking Vancouver by storm with his podcast and various appearances about town. It started in the summer of 2018 and really ramped up into the fall of that year as Mo had various candidates in the municipal election on his show. His conversational style and interest in a variety of issues, as well as his eagerness to get to know his guests, makes his show a popular listen, as well as a stop for activists, artists, public figures, politicians, and everybody in between. I'll ask Mo Amir about why he started his show, about this part of the world we live in, and where he sees it headed. You take the opioid crisis and the challenges of living in such an expensive city, as well as the natural tensions that come with a pluralistic society, not just race, but class. For some, it may not be a wholly enjoyable place to live in, or even a place one would want to live in. But Mo, through his show and its guests, allows us a chance to talk about what confronts us and what makes this place as special and as colorful as it is. I'll ask him about who he's enjoyed talking to over the last year or so, and where he'd like to take the show into the future. Mo Amir is a graduate of Simon Fraser University. He works in the forestry sector and is a regular contributor to Linda Steele's show on CKNW. At Vancolor is the Twitter handle, and the website for the show is at thisisvancolor.com. Please welcome to the Plante on the Line program, Mo Amir. Mr. Amir, good morning.
Joseph, that was a really nice intro. Thank you so much.
I'm out of breath, so you can vamp if you want. Yeah.
I was going to say, I thought that was very sweet of you, and I like that you pointed out that I do take a genuine human interest and an emotional interest in all my guests, because that's really the crux of it, and that's what makes me do it. But I have to say, first and foremost, it is an honor to be here. The fact that you've been doing this for so long is not only remarkable, it's incredible. So episode 1800, episode whatever, it's a real pleasure, and I thank you for inviting me.
Well, what are you up to now? You're up to the last show with...
I'm up to 56. Yeah, well, you've got some ways to go, man.
But it's they're 56 great shows. I mean, even if they're people that I don't know or don't even like, frankly...
we can get into that later.
It makes it compelling listening because you bring such an earnest sort of, interest in the people that you talk to. Why the podcast? Why did you decide? Because you obviously have a day job. You're busy.
Sure.
Why did you want to do this?
That's a great question. And I think with anything in life, sometimes you just, when you have an idea, just don't think about it and go into it. And that's kind of what I did. And I didn't think about results or what I wanted out of it. I had this idea of doing basically a Joe Rogan experience for the Vancouver audience, and I just went with it. I didn't think about why I'm doing it or what's motivating me, and kind of developed a love and motivation as I was doing it. But I think whenever you start a big project, no matter what it is, even if you're trying to lose weight or get in shape or whatever it is, it's very hard to take that first step because you want to question yourself and why you're doing it. So I just avoided thinking about that.
Now, you know most of these people, don't you?
No, I don't think that's true. I've followed some of their careers or I'll see something in the news about them. Some of them I have known, like Ivan Decker.
Yeah.
I've known very casually for over 10 years, and it was cool to have him on the show. But no, generally speaking, I don't know these people.
Yeah, but the podcast is a marvelous entree into getting to know people you want to know.
Absolutely, yeah.
You're just getting to talk to them, right?
Yeah.
Why the name Vancolor?
I was looking for a play on words for Vancouver, and I went through the obvious, like Rain City or something else, and just came up with that name Vancolor, and you know when you have something that you really like, you just go with it, so didn't think about it.
And how do you find the time? Because you obviously have a job in the forestry sector. And you know, we heard you on the news in recent months when the port strike was happening, and so I mean, you were obviously you have commitments there. How do you find the time to do this?
You know what the biggest lifesaver is? This is a life hack that I'm going to share with you.
Sure.
Don't have kids. I don't have children. I have very few responsibilities except for myself, so I have a lot of time. It has eaten up a lot of time. Like I was, I was going to the yoga studio twice a week, or twice a day, I should say. So I can't do that anymore. But I make the time.
Yeah. The sort of guests that you have on, I mean, they really reflect the city in a way, because you have various areas of whether they're artists, say, or people in show business, or people in the other branch of show business, politics. Is it hard to sort of, I mean, when you look at 56 shows, I mean, it's a, you know, almost a year, about over a year of
yeah,
shows.
Yeah, about a year and a half.
Yeah. Do you look back and say that it's representative, say, of the city itself in the last year? So, I mean, is a time capsule even?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there's different angles and different aspects of the city that I like to represent, and some of it is politics, some of it is comedy, some of it is health. There's so many different ways to view this city. It's hard to get one guest that's going to encapsulate everything. Sure. Unless they're a historian, and even then they're going to take their own angles. So, yeah, there's so many interesting people, there's so many interesting things happening here, there's so many interesting conversations happening here, that it really allows me to sort of pursue what I'm into that week or yeah. that month and have the guests that I want on.
Yeah, because, I mean, we were talking just before we started about mm-hmm. what we were going to talk about in this chat. And naturally, we brainstormed as to, you know, what's in the news and the sort of
sure,
this time of day. And so I guess, is that something that you when you tape your show, I mean, that's something you obviously bring into the studio and bring into with your guests, right?
Yeah, I mean, I just have an interest in...
Whatever's in the zeitgeist, the culture, politics, and the sort, right?
Yes. Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that, obviously, we're talking about sort of topical things. I like my episodes to have a little more shelf life than just a day or a week,
yeah.
so I don't try to be too topical.
Sure.
And I try to hit at more cultural issues
yeah.
and larger issues so that the episodes will have a larger shelf life. But yeah, you know, I've always had an interest in politics. I was always reading the news the newspaper, I should say. That was something that my parents really ingrained in me. So just keeping an eye out on what's happening in my city and my community has always been important to me. And I think I try to reflect that in the podcast itself.
In terms of politics itself, it really, your show struck a chord, as well as the Cam B Report and Seeking Office at CITR during last
great
year's,
shows, by the way.
Yeah,
great
during
shows.
Last year's municipal election, because I found that, as someone who's a political junkie, mm-hmm. It filled a gap that, say, the other people weren't doing, the sort of traditional media.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. I interviewed Patrick Condon, and then I had Kennedy Stewart on, and Kennedy Stewart agreed to it before it was even a podcast.
Yeah.
And I just saw that was resonating with people, so I just went full gear with it and had a bunch of municipal candidates on as much as I could before the actual election. But it wasn't supposed to be like a politics-only podcast, mm-hmm. but I kind of fell into that. In terms of the space that we're filling, I think we're in a bit of a paradox with our culture. In one hand, we have shorter and shorter attention spans, but on the other hand, we crave long-form content. We mm-hmm. still read books. We you know, it's almost good for our soul in a way to listen to to watch a docuseries and learn something, or listen to a long-form podcast. So it's weird. There is this paradox, and I think long-form podcasting and long-form interviews, which you can't really pull off on the radio or you can't really pull off on TV, are prime for podcasts to get into, mm-hmm. and people like them.
Yeah, and again, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of your lineup over these last 18 months or so, there are people that I like, and there are people that I don't like. I might not listen to that day. You know what I mean?
Sure. And that's the point. I don't think the show is... I knew when I was making this that not every episode is going to be for everyone. So there's going to be some people who just like silly comedy shows, and they will listen to the comedians or someone else. There are going to be people who only like the substantive policy discussions that are going to stick to those episodes. So I certainly don't demand my listeners listen to every single podcast that I put out. But hopefully there's something there for everyone.
You've gotten a lot of goodwill online from followers and
thank
listeners
you.
On Twitter. And
some bad will, too, you know.
Yeah,
it's a mix.
Some criticism, and I want to just touch on that because I think it gives a fuller picture. Where I started hearing it was during after the Andrew Wilkinson interview dropped.
Mm-hmm.
There was criticism about him, obviously, and then there was some talk about you. Was any of that serious in your mind, the fact that you'd, say, been a contributor and that's why he'd been on your show?
No, I mean, that was such a weird incident because I started that program and that episode with a full disclosure mm-hmm. to Andrew Wilkinson about how I used to be a member and how I've contributed, and not only time but also money. So I thought I was doing the right thing by coming out and saying that. And then it was weird that people, particularly one blogger in this city, like turned that around and made that the reason why Andrew Wilkinson came on the show, even though on CKNW, on Twitter, on my own podcast, I've been very critical of him and mm-hmm. the BC Liberals. So there was no reason, like, I don't know, it was made out to be this, like, scratch my back, scratch your back thing, but it wasn't. I'm on good terms with his team. We still chat every now and then, talk about a potential show in the future with another BC Liberal, perhaps. Mm-hmm. I didn't think there was that much criticism on me. I think there was that one sort of blog article, and there were some people that chirped in online, but I didn't really see that. What was interesting was I had that episode, and then before that I had Anne McMullen from UDI, from the Urban Development Institute, on, and I just remember there was like a dump of criticism on that. Mm-hmm. And I thought Anne was a great guest. I thought she was very interesting. But there were a lot of people, including people in the media, that were really going hard at her in that episode. But on a selfish note, it was very nice when they would add, you know, but Mo did a great job interviewing. So you can't take stuff like that personally. Everything you produce or put out is not going to be liked by everyone.
And so what motivates you to keep it going? I mean, other than, say, just the fact that you get to meet these people and talk to them and have these discussions about important topics, or mm-hmm. fun topics, if you will, as well. Do you see yourself? I mean, how do you see yourself in this sort of the discourse, especially the mix of online and media that we're sort of living in this era?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't try to think about it too much, or I don't try to pigeonhole myself too much, but I would say that I have no stakes in this. You know, I'm doing it for fun.
Yeah.
So I can walk away from this as soon as I get bored, but I'm not. I have, like I said, an emotional investment in guests that I have on. And until the point where I'm just out of ideas of who to bring on or what to talk about, then I'll stop. But in terms of what motivates me, I love meeting these people. And I love putting out meaningful pieces. I love when, and this again, it sounds selfish and egotistical or whatever, but I love when I get those emails of someone who's listened to an episode and said, that was really touching, or that really moved me. Thank you for producing that. And that's great. And that's great validation to have. But ultimately, I'm doing it for me. I like the people that I meet. And yeah, if you can shake things up a little bit and get people talking about something you produced, you know, all the better.
The other thing that I, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, it's sort of the Please. Perception that I have in terms of what the show is and mm-hmm. what it could be, is when you talk about the city, and we're all doing that, right?
Yeah.
It's so bloody expensive. We're worried about where it's headed.
Yeah.
You come at it at a place of affection, obviously, because you love this place.
Yes.
You've lived here, you know, your whole life, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my parents immigrated here when I was four, so in terms of my memory, yes.
Sure, yeah. So this is the place that you've known, and this is home, essentially.
Absolutely.
And so you are concerned about where it's headed, and you know, you're ringing alarm bells when they need to be rung.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see this? I mean, this place. I mean, how does the story end, if you will? I mean, because this is something that I mean, I've been doing this a while, and this is something that we've been talking about over the years. I mean, it goes in cycles. Obviously, some days it's more important than others. But, you know, a lot of us are worried about this place and what it could turn into.
We should be worried. And, you know, after I talked to Max Fawcett, who you've had on the show several times, I think I became more of a pessimist. I mean, he's kind of given up on the city, at least in some of his rhetoric. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, there is an argument that we've become a resort town.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have skin in the game in terms of equity, if you're not on that ladder already, man, it's real tough. And if you're going to move here, it's real tough, and there's so many people here with rental insecurity, even people who have mortgages. You know, they're 50% of their take-home pay might be going towards that mortgage. That's not a great lifestyle, and I've had several friends that have moved away, and yes, they miss the city, they might miss their friends, but when they think about their lifestyle now, the fact that they can have a house, they can have, you know, a yard, they're not worried, they're not talking about housing all the time. They have no desire to come back, and that's really sad. And we've seen it in different communities that are being hollowed out. What's the end game for Vancouver? I have no idea. I mean, I want to be an optimist about it. I think the solution, though, and maybe people won't like this idea, but I think we have to create a certain dichotomy in our housing market. There's going to be no political party municipally, provincially or federally, that's going to do something that's going to tank home equities, right? That's just political suicide. It's never going to happen. So what you can have is you can have the housing market, but then you really need, especially the federal government, to invest money in social housing, in co-ops, in all sorts of housing that low-income and middle-income even as well can live in. And we have to remove the stigma from that, especially for middle-income. And there are cities that have done it. You know, Vienna's a good example of that. So I think the only solution here is that we need to have this dichotomy of, yes, okay, we'll keep the market side, but then we're really going to invest heavily and build heavily on the non-market side. And then when you suck out those low-income, middle-income people out of the market, then you kind of stabilize the market side as well, yeah. Right? So, again, I'm not a policy guy. To me, that kind of makes sense. But otherwise, I think at the rate we're going at and how expensive housing is and the fact that you have a generation of people, including myself, and I'm very privileged, who were brought up on this idea that you grow up, you have a family, you buy a place, and that's and you've made it.
Yeah.
We've been told that our whole lives, and it's just not possible anymore.
But again, you know, because of the minority government situation in Ottawa, mm-hmm. That could very well be a possibility. With the NDP and the Liberals could you know really invest in social housing and Canadian mortgage and housing.
Mm-hmm.
CHMC.
The Liberals have really let us down on that.
They've dropped the ball, obviously, yeah. So, but at the same time, you know, it's one thing to build, say, developments that are rental only, that are social housing only. Mm-hmm. But you have to also build the infrastructure thing, and these yeah. things cost money, right?
Yeah.
And so now we're adding up the bill, if you will.
Of course, yeah. The problem is I think we are decades behind.
Right.
We stopped investment, from my understanding, in the Martin years, at least when he was finance
sure.
minister,
yeah.
In social housing. And now we're really paying for it. And it's tough when you're that far behind to catch up, especially on things like infrastructure. But it has to be done, and they have to figure out a way. And I think especially in the urban centers of Vancouver, in the urban centers of other communities as well, taking away the dependence from cars. And it's, I hate saying that because I drive a car, and I drive a car a lot.
Yeah.
But effectively, I drive a car because it's a 30-minute drive for work for me, or it's an hour and a half by bus.
Yeah.
There's no other option. If I could do that trek in 40 minutes on a bus or on a train, I would absolutely do it, but
yeah.
I can't.
So again, you know, now we're at a point now where we've got all these you know, things we'd like to fulfill,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, getting a government, whether it's a left-wing even if it's a left-wing government in particular,
sure.
to spend money,
yeah.
I mean, again, it's not politically feasible, right?
I don't know. I haven't looked at the balance sheets enough to know what's feasible and what's not.
I just can't see it being a sellable thing in the newspapers or in the media. You know what I mean? You'd get a lot of criticism for whoever would propose this.
Yeah. It's tough because I think we don't necessarily – I mean, the Liberals did do a good job, and I think the NDP also on a federal level did a good job in terms of sort of having a national vision. But I think we do need a government – from the center or from the left or maybe even from the right, I don't know, but a party that has a national vision, but then also for the major metropolises in Canada have a vision for them as well. And I think that's what we're lacking in terms of being able to sell it to the public. We see this wealth disparity around the world, and Canada is not immune from that. And there's a lot of people going, hey, where's all the wealth that our country is generating? We have so many natural resources here. Where is that going? Where's that money going? And, you know, you have now in the U.S., you literally have presidential candidates saying there shouldn't be such things as billionaires.
Yeah.
And that argument is becoming more and more convincing and persuasive every day. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying there's people that's gaining – it's gaining traction,
right.
That idea. So the money's got to come from somewhere. The government does have assets. I think it's about priorities. It's about taking the politics out of it. And when I say taking the politics out of it, I mean – it's not about ideology. The province and the federal government and the municipalities have to work together, even if they're not on the same board,
right.
quote unquote, politically.
Yeah, and then we have seen that in certain aspects. I mean, you look back to when Vision was in power here in Vancouver. You know, there was some sort of working together in terms of, you ask Andrea Reimer, some working together with the provincial government of the day, the Liberal government.
Yeah.
On some issues.
They had some common friends and a few developers.
Sure,
I think.
Yeah. That makes it easier, I suppose. You know.
But there were other situations where they weren't really working together,
yeah.
right, when we talk about the downtown east side.
Correct, right.
And I'm not an expert on that stuff, but I know that it's difficult, and some of it just becomes politics.
You had a rant right before this last federal election.
I have a lot of rants.
This is one that I remember now. Decrying crony capitalism.
Yeah.
And looking for urging people that if they believe that, to vote for a party that sort of would espouse the same views. And I was listening to you, you know, say this, I was thinking, what party federally would actually do that? Or feels
that
way.
And I don't know if I was advocating to vote for a certain party that doesn't. I was advocating to demand our politicians and our candidates to disavow corporate cronyism. You look at the oil and gas sector.
Yeah.
And I'm not here to debate pipelines.
Sure.
That's not my wheelhouse. But you look at the oil and gas sector, they take $3.3 billion worth of subsidies every year. A lot of that's provincial, but they get some federal funding as well. You look at even on a petty, small level, you know, why is the Trudeau government giving free energy-efficient refrigerators to Loblaws? They don't need it. They can afford it. And it's just waste like that that I think really upsets people because it's corporate welfare. It's corporate cronyism. And so much of politics is driven around making certain sectors and certain companies happy. And there's almost this trend of, you know, when companies in certain sectors make money, oh, they make money hand over fist, they're spending, it's great. And that's capitalism, that's amazing. But then suddenly when they start losing money, they come to the government for a handout and for help based on some argument of jobs or whatever. And it's like, well, it has to be a two-way street. And I think we've come, we may not be the worst country in it, but I think, you know, on a principled level, government should be working for people, not corporations. And yes, corporations are an amalgamation of people, that's fine, but ultimately, they have to be working for regular, everyday people, not giving out free stuff and tax breaks to corporations. I mean, you look at even just our tax law.
Mm-hmm.
It's complicated and huge because that benefits big corporations. They can hire the lawyers and the accountants to ensure that they minimize the taxes that they pay. That only benefits big companies. It doesn't benefit regular people. So I think just, again, maybe it's idealistic, and I'll take that criticism, that's fine, but I just think as the citizenry, as people who live in this country, we need to start demanding more of our political parties, of our candidates, and a lot of that starts with just ending corporate cronyism. And does that party exist right now? No. I mean, if Jack Layton was prime minister, you'd still have the same SNC problems, and they might have still passed a DPA legislation.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm speculating that probably they would. So I'm not under the guise that the NDP is, you know, completely anti-corporate, but I just think we need to demand better of all parties on all sides.
So,
and this is a right, and
sure.
Sorry to go on another rant for you,
yeah.
But this is also like a right-wing argument, right? Like I'm sitting in the center-left, but the right should be more upset about this. Like the right is all about free markets and letting companies prosper and fail without interference. But we're interfering in a way where we're giving them handouts, and I think that's wrong.
So if there aren't parties that are championing this, are there certain politicians that you look to for, say, inspiration in terms of in this country? I mean, mm-hmm. You're obviously there's some on the Democratic running for the Democratic nomination in the United States, but are there people in this part of the world even that you think the same way as you do?
I think so. I mean, when you look at what the NDP did by taking corporate donations off the table in this province, I think that was a huge move, you know, and that was a real good step in the right direction. And I think that's going to have implications as we move forward in this province. In terms of specific people, it's hard to say. I mean, a lot of people that would advocate for something like that are simply not in power. So it's hard to say what they would be like if they're in office. But I think you're starting to see a little movement on that. I know when I posted that rant, you know, the mayor of Port Coquitlam, Brad West, was fully supportive, and he reposted it and said that I was talking his language, which I thought was very nice of him to do. So I think there are certainly politicians in agreement, or people that want to be in politics that are in agreement of that sentiment. But it is, I think, going to take a public consciousness and a public demand for greater action on these things.
And in bravery on the part of the decision makers, obviously, which politicians are necessarily known for courage.
Yeah, who are known for bravery. Yeah, exactly.
Will you do more of these rants?
Here and there, yeah. So I made that sort of as a test. I called it colorful language, or, you know, working on the van color thing. I would like to do more. I think I just have to be inspired. I don't know if they're going to be like a regular thing. And I don't even know if they're always going to be about politics. But yeah, to have that like 2-3 minute little mini podcast where it's just me ranting about something, I would absolutely love to do that. Because a couple of my big inspirations, especially growing up, and this is going to sound kind of funny, but was Ed the Sock, who I contribute on his podcast too, which is so much fun. But Ed the Sock used to have these editorials, and they'd be these big rants, and they'd be amazing. And then the other guy was Dennis Miller.
Right.
From SNL. He's kind of gone quite to the right now. But at the time, I remember seeing the Dennis Miller show, and there was this guy who was so articulate, and he was using all these literary allusions, but then he was also cursing at the same time. And I just thought that was amazing. And I didn't understand 80% of what he was saying when I was 13 years old watching him talk, but I loved it. I just loved that format. So, yeah, I hope so.
Who did you take inspiration from in terms of the podcast itself, in terms of the way that you do it? I mean, that must have been gleaned from someone.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people that cringe when I give this answer.
Yeah, you mentioned Rogan.
It's really Rogan. Yeah. It's absolutely Rogan, because you look at what Joe Rogan has done, and yes, he is not immune from criticism. There's some stuff about him that I don't like, but what I admire of what he did is he's created the space where you can have conversations. And yeah, some of them are silly and dumb and maybe even offensive, but then some of them are really substantive. The fact that Bernie Sanders goes on that show and he's on for 2 hours talking to Joe, it was incredible, you know. Yeah. And Tulsi Gabbard did the same thing. And I think what he's created is that space of, hey, I'm going to put out the show. Not every episode is for everyone, but you can either learn something or you can be entertained. And do I take inspiration from that? Absolutely. Am I trying to be Joe Rogan in every aspect of who Joe Rogan is? No, I'm my own person. So,
yeah. And you never shy away from giving your own view of things, which I find refreshing, because too many people that interview other people, myself included, don't like to do that. You know what I mean? I don't like to, you know, this is, I ask the questions and then, you know, the guest answers. But I mean, you bring to the show this freshness in terms of giving us what you think, and whether it's right or wrong, the guests can then give their views on whatever topic it is.
Yeah, I think that's the freedom of being completely independent, and you don't have a corporate overlord, you know, watching what you're doing or what you're saying, is that, yeah, you can be opinionated. And I don't shy away from saying that I have these opinions or I'm partisan on certain things. You know, I just had, I don't know when this is going out, but
yeah.
I just had David Eby on. That episode is coming out November 18th.
Uh-huh.
And at the start of the show, I openly declare I'm a fan of yours. You know, how many interviewers are going to do that? But it also just creates a different style than what we see in the mainstream media. And this is not a knock on mainstream media. They have to be objective. They do an amazing job at what they do. But they can't have like that person-to-person conversation. Or if they do, the interviewer still has to be somewhat neutral. Whereas, yeah, if I really like someone, I will absolutely tell them that I like them, or that I followed their career, or I like this, or I don't like that. And you know, it's a cool freedom, but it also requires some humility and consideration, because, and I've been guilty of this. Sometimes you post things on Twitter or say something that you're just like, ah, you know what? Maybe I shouldn't have insulted that person or gone hard at a certain issue because I didn't know that as much as I thought I did. So, it, you know, and I've been burned on that, and I'll take my lumps for that, absolutely. But I think the beauty of being independent and doing whatever you want is you can do that, and you can change. And I think you almost have to do that, right? Because what would differentiate us from what CBC is producing or what CKNW is producing? We have to have our own flavor and our own style. And what's easier than just being yourself and being authentic?
I was just thinking, I couldn't have EB on the show because he'd be too tall for this room, wouldn't he?
He could fit in here. He's a tall guy. I took a picture with him, and I look like a little kid. And I'm 6 foot tall, so.
What, we talked about Don Cherry before we started. About whether we would talk about him or not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm exhausted talking about him.
Yeah, me too, a little bit, but we can chew the fat on this.
I guess this is an important issue because when race is involved, the people that should be talking about it aren't usually. I mean, we heard all last week, all Don Cherry defending himself or explaining himself, but you know he's not the right person to talk about race, is he?
Oh man, yeah. So you've opened up the can of worms here. Is he the right person to talk about race? I think anyone can talk about race as long as you come into the conversation with good faith.
But then the people that people who are, say, racialized are usually the people that are left out of these conversations.
Yes, absolutely. And that, but that's what I mean by good faith, is that just because you're white doesn't mean you can't engage in a conversation about race, but you can't tell racialized people how they're supposed to feel, is my point. I think with Don Cherry, what this exposed was a real dark underbelly and maybe an undercurrent that we have in Canada right now. There were a lot of defenders, and there were defenders in the media for him. And their defenders were twofold. First of all, people were calling this a free speech issue. Well, excuse me, free speech only applies to the government's sanction of your speech. It doesn't apply to what you can or can't say on any platform. And the platform is allowed to pull you over anything they want, right? So it's not about free speech. The second issue is that the right-wing conservative response to the Don Cherry dismissal, resignation, whatever you want to call it, was, oh, people are hung up on the words, you people. And it's like, no, he said, you people, you that come here, you enjoy our milk and honey. You enjoy our way of life. Like, he's making that divisiveness. And the thing is, how do you know, when you're walking in Vancouver, how do you know someone is an immigrant?
Right?
You have multi-generational Chinese-Canadian families here, multi-generational Indo-Canadian families here. So how would you possibly know? The only way to make that distinction is you see race. There could be a white guy from Europe who comes here, but...
he's a tourist.
Yeah, exactly. But Don Cherry's not talking about that. So when he's identifying you and our and all that other stuff, he's implying race. And I think it was extremely problematic. It was weird that they taped it and it aired three times and no one there thought anything. Everything I've heard about Ron McLean is amazing. Karis Hogg from Jack FM met Ron McLean and talked about meeting Ron McLean on my show. And she said, you know, the nicest things about him. I've heard other things that people have said about him. He sounds like a nice guy. I just wonder, maybe he was just tuning it out and not really paying attention.
Or the thumbs up might have meant, hey, this is the end.
Like, let's just get, yeah, we're let's
wrapped,
go.
Right?
Yeah. He doesn't look comfortable in that space. But yeah, you know, this whole Don Cherry thing was absolutely ridiculous. And it was funny, you know, I had a tweet blow up, and as we discussed, Twitter isn't real life, but but I had these, like, either they were bots or just, you know, some people who were commenting, and I got called all sorts of names, which was really fun.
Yeah.
But I just couldn't understand why they were so defensive for this guy. And are those people that pro poppy? And I'm pro poppy. I was wearing a poppy, but you know, are these people so pro poppy that there's something else there, is my point. And the defense of him, and you just look at the he went on Tucker Carlson, right? You look at the angle that he's working, and it's kind of gross. And I don't think we have to, we can't hide from this, and we can't hide from what's happening with regards to a certain undercurrent in our country. And it's an ugly undercurrent, and some people call it, you know, populism, some people call it nationalism or right-wing nationalism. What it boils down to is, I think you can be a nationalist and I think you can be a populist without being racist. And racism is sort of the undercurrent, and that's you know, that's scary.
And I mean, the federal election result I think sort of was another demonstration of what's happening in this country.
Well, thankfully, Bernier lost big.
Yeah.
He didn't even get his own seat. I think what we saw during the federal election, that was kind of nasty too, right? Like, let's talk about blackface. You know, again, I think the media in this country is really professional. I think they mostly do a good job. But what I didn't like was this narrative of calling it brownface, because there's no such thing as brownface.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a South Asian, and I'll tell you, a South Asian cannot give you, unless they studied the history they can't give you the proper context of why blackface is offensive. So having a South Asian commentator on telling you, oh, you know, it's not a big deal, that just doesn't fly with me. Like, let's hear more black voices. And Desmond Cole was a guy that, you know, he was on the media a little bit, and he had some great takes on it, and we should have all listened to what black people were saying. And maybe some black people weren't offended. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, that conversation of race was really weird. The conversation around Jagmeet Singh being a racialized leader was kind of weird, where he has NDP supporters telling him, oh, get rid of the turban, cut your beard, whatever. And, again, it was there were a lot of things in that federal election that were very uncomfortable as a Canadian for me to watch. And I want to be really clear. I don't like the race card. I don't like using, quote-unquote, using the race card. And I generally don't for my personal life. If I fail at something, if something doesn't go my way, I never say, oh, it's because I'm brown. I don't say that.
Yeah.
But I do think it's important for all of us to point out racial biases in the political culture, in the culture in general, in media culture. And not just racial biases, but biases against women, biases against LGBTQ people. And as a racialized person, I think I'm more sensitive to seeing racial biases, whether they're against South Asians or other races. So I definitely point them out where I see them in trying to create a larger dialogue. And if I see them, you know, against women or against LGBTQ people, I will definitely point them out as well where I can. But that doesn't mean you're playing the race card, you know.
Yeah.
And I hate that response when I will say something about race, or someone on my show will say something about race, and then you get this response of, oh, you got to stop playing the race card. And it's like, no, we can talk about race.
Yeah.
and we can point out structural issues without it being, without self-victimizing ourselves.
And this again points to a conversation about race that we need to have, but I don't think we are prepared to have, are we? Because, I mean, the minute that you bring something up, people will say, hey, don't do that.
Yeah, so let me, and you don't get to throw out your opinion, so let me ask you, why don't you think we're prepared to have that conversation?
Well, I think you look at what happened to Singh during that campaign.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of talk about how unprepared he was to be a leader, and granted, you know, he didn't know, when he was running for the NDP leadership, he didn't impress me. As people were saying that, you know, he was sort of our version of Obama, if you will, and things like that.
Yeah.
I didn't think he spoke as well as
yeah, I would agree. He didn't impress me until the last week of the election,
no,
really.
Yeah, and then
after, or last month, I should say.
Yeah, and then that incident in Quebec where the guy comes up to him. Again, this is my blind spot. I mean, my parents are Filipino, and I look mm-hmm. Filipino. I never really thought about it, right? And when he said that that's something that he has encountered regularly,
mm-hmm.
people that look like him encounter regularly, every day even. My first feeling was I felt bad, right? Because I've never experienced anything sort of, you know, any racism, any prejudice that he obviously gets
mm-hmm.
regularly. And so, again, that made me think about, yeah, well, that was my privilege over the last, you know, 37 years, is that I've never encountered
ever
anything. No, I can't think of anything.
Really?
You know? Yeah. I mean, I've had people come up to me and, you know, start, you know, talking in Filipino.
Oh, okay.
Right? You know,
well,
that's not, you know, that's not.
But did you ever experience it casually where someone will say, hey, so where are you from? And you go, yeah. Oh, I'm from Vancouver. And they go, no. Where are you really from?
Yeah, I've had that, but I mean,
And again, I don't know how much malice is behind that. Usually not, but it is kind of annoying sometimes. And they've already pegged you in their mind as something that maybe you're not.
Yeah,
because
the thing I get all the time is the ageism thing. You know?
I mean, oh yeah.
I'll talk about, you know, because I've read a book or two in my life
mm-hmm.
and know a thing or two about history. People say, "How do you know that? You're too young to know that." Well, you know, it's nonsense when people say that. And
yeah.
And I get that a lot, and that's probably more offensive to me than say, you know, where are you really from?
Right. Sure. And you have a fair argument there. I think so. In my experience, the big turning point for me was growing up, and then I was in grade 11, and 9/11 happened, and no one cared about my family's religion or our background or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in North Van; it was really nice. And then suddenly this became a thing. And not that we were even super religious, but it just became a thing. And, you know, I have Nexus, mm-hmm. which allows you to go to the border. It's kind of a pre-check if anyone doesn't know. But I have Nexus, and I get pulled into the room every time when I go down to the States. So, again, nothing happens. They do their background check, but I'm in there for half an hour, 40 minutes. And then they say, yeah, you're free to go. And I go, and then I come back, and it's no problem. But literally every time I get pulled into
the room. So how do you not make that feel personal?
My point. Yeah, That's exactly my point.
But, I mean, you know, people shouldn't have to go through that, obviously, because you're going to get late for your flight or whatever.
Yeah.
So how do you, I mean, if you have to cross the border, I mean, does that preclude you from wanting to cross the border, say?
Oh, I mean, I'll still go down and go to Trader Joe's or whatever else, but I do have to plan for it. And I do get, it's weird because I do get nervous going down there.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And even, you know, my friends say, you know, why are you so nervous? And it's like, because I just know, and I wasn't nervous at the start, but certainly when it happens every time, you just kind of get nervous about getting pulled into the room and answering the same questions. And it's to people who don't understand it and they're like, oh, it's not a big deal. I wouldn't have thought it was a big deal until I had to do it.
Yeah, because it's like, yeah, now I'm thinking. Because you're obviously exhausted from answering the same questions.
I just, a 40-minute holdup for nothing. Sure. And then I have a clean criminal record, that's why I have Nexus.
Yeah. And the way you comport yourself, and if you just say you're annoyed by one question that you've heard a million times already, you know, that automatically sets off something in the person asking the question or someone behind the mirror, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. But to go back to your original point, like, I think Canada is ready for this conversation. It's uncomfortable.
But how do we have it, though? Because so many people are so reticent to have it.
I think we need to have it in the media. I think we need more racialized voices in the media, for one. We're doing a really good job, I should say. Like, I'm not saying that we're completely not racialized in the media. We're doing a good job, but we need more of that in this conversation. And we also need, quote-unquote, white Canadians as well. Like I said, I think no one should be precluded from joining this conversation as long as they come in with good faith. And if they have questions or if there's something they don't understand, whether they're racialized or not racialized, being able to ask that question without judgment and knowing that everyone at the table is talking in good faith. But sometimes that response, as we've seen in the Don Cherry defense, doesn't feel like it's in good faith. It feels like it's an attack, and they attack, you know, the sensitivities of the left, or they attack cancel culture. And Don Cherry's rant itself, I don't think it was in good faith. The fact that he says, I should have said everybody, but then refuses to apologize. Because I will say things on my show, or maybe sometimes even on the radio, that I'm like, ah, I wish I didn't say it that way. Nothing terribly offensive. But if I, you know, when called on it, I'll absolutely say, yeah, you know what? I didn't say it the right way. I didn't articulate myself properly. I'm sorry if people took offense to it. That seems like a very normal thing to do, and it's a good faith thing to do.
And everything I've read, the TikTok I read in the Globe and Mail on Saturday morning about what it was like there, seemed to suggest that he was asked to apologize. He refused, and then that's why he was fired on Monday.
Yeah, I think that's the implication, because there was so much time between the fallout and the fact that Ron McLean came out and said it, and Sportsnet put in a message. So I'm sure they were begging him to apologize. And why he didn't do it, I think, I don't know.
It speaks more to him than I think everything
else. It's indicative that what he said was not in good faith.
And then
and
now,
he knows what he said.
And now what's happening is you're going to have people, himself, supporters of his, as well as, you know, free speech defenders will bandwagon this thing and say, you know, well, this means it's something to do with it could be everything from ageism, because he's 85 and, you know, he misspoke, as most people that age do, or it's a corporate thing that they'd always wanted him out, and this was an easy excuse for them to get him out finally, to, you know, waving the banner of free speech and the sort. So it's not an elegant way to end this career or begin this conversation that should happen.
You know, sometimes you can make chicken salad out of chicken shit. So,
well, it doesn't mean I'm going to eat it, though, right?
Well, I mean, listen, if it tastes exactly like chicken salad, I don't know. I might try it.
But
it's interesting. You know, we go back to these free speech advocates, and you and I talked about this a little earlier before we started, but where are they on this news that Brad West broke about mainland Chinese ancestry people, people who have Hong Kong ancestry people in our country, within our borders, being harassed by the Chinese government? Yeah. That's a free speech issue, by the way. Yeah. Not Don Cherry. The free speech issue, if we're going to have that conversation, should be happening around this and how people within our borders are being harassed by a foreign government for something that they post on social media. That is a free speech issue.
And, again, it'll continue on your show. I mean, you'll probably have West on again, won't you?
I would love to have Brad West on.
Great copy, doesn't he?
He's so good.
Yeah.
I tell everyone that we're bros, and as far as everyone should be concerned, we are absolutely bros. So I would, I hope to have him back on soon.
It's a beard thing, isn't it?
He doesn't have a beard.
All the pictures I see, he's got some growth, doesn't he?
Does he? Yeah. I think maybe some stubble.
Maybe I'm,
you're making me question my life now. Hold on. How do I not know if my bro... I got to look this up. How do I not know if my bro has a beard or not?
As someone who goes through the ritual of the pain in the
ass... He does have a beard. Shit.
To shave every day. Yeah. I notice these things. You know what I mean?
He doesn't have a full beard. It's not like mine. I was thinking like this gross like Neanderthal beard. But no, he doesn't have that. But yes, he does have a beard.
How often are you on with Linda?
Every now and then, yeah. We had a good streak there for a while, and then the election came on, and we're just kind of at a point. Linda's amazing. She's been so supportive, but it was becoming a lot for me, and I just said, hey, how about I just pitch you a good idea when I have one? So hopefully I'll be on soon. I love CKNW. Steele's amazing. I learned so much from her just watching her. And, you know, it's a different medium too, man. Like, this long-form stuff is fun. It's a conversation. Yeah. But when you're in that capsule of, like, 10-minute segments and 10-minute spots, it's, for me, I never got over the high pressure of it. Because you want to get out your interesting, articulate points, but you don't have time to really breathe, or at least I felt like I didn't. But it's a different spot. I loved it. It flexed new muscle. I like doing the media spots. In general, I did some stuff with CBC as well. But that's a bonus, man. That's a blessing and that's a bonus, and I love doing that. But the focus is always my own podcast.
Yeah, the I've always admired her work as a journalist, and you know, I like her as a broadcaster. And when I heard her on your show, it only validated everything that I liked about
amazing.
Her. You know, and to hear about her career and about her family life and the sort, I just thought that it made sense as to why I liked her.
Yeah, I've been very blessed that people like Linda Steele will come on the show and just wear it on their sleeve and be open and authentic. And I love that because they don't necessarily have, they certainly don't have like an hour to talk about themselves or talk about things in that way on their own show. So it's really, I'm very humbled that I can have guests that feel comfortable doing that. And I hope that resonates with people. I know that Steele episode is very popular, and you know I've had other media personalities on, and I feel like you get to see them and hear from them in a very different light.
Yeah, but where do you see this show going? I mean, we talked a moment earlier in the interview about where we're seeing this city headed, and chronicling that, I suppose, and the different ideas about where we're going and how to get to where we want to go. I mean, that's something that you're going to constantly do on your show, right?
Yeah, chronicling it in a very disjointed, non-linear way, sure. Where it goes, again, like I said, as soon as I get bored of it, I can stop. You know, it's not... I don't know if I have long-term plans. And especially, I think, when something is your passion project or your hobby, I don't like tying tangible results or a tangible vision to what it is. I just like to focus on the process and make sure that I'm enjoying the process. Because if I'm not enjoying that, then who cares about the tangible results? Because this is a passion project. It's not my livelihood.
Yeah.
So in terms of where it's going, I just like to shake shit up. And I like to have people that say things that will get, you know, other people's heads turning. And that doesn't mean being wildly controversial. It just means having candid conversations with people where they say things that, you know, maybe they won't say in their job or in the formats that you know them in. So I'm just sticking to the process. I don't have particularly big goals. I just did the Vancouver Podcast Festival, which was so much fun.
Yeah, yeah.
I would love to do that again in 2020. And maybe I did a crossover show because it was my first live show. I've never done anything like that.
Uh-huh.
But, How's this? I'm going to throw out an open invitation, and you should let everyone know that I threw this out there as well. I want Brad West on my show live at the Vancouver Podcast.
That'd be fun. Yeah.
That's a tangible goal that I actually do have.
There you go.
And I've been blowing up Brad's phone about it, and I want him. I want his commitment. So,
who has turned you down that you've asked for that you want on our show?
Oh man, sir? Good question. I haven't heard back from Stephen Quinn yet, so I guess that's not a rejection. It's just I haven't heard back from him. That's a guy that I want on. I was in talks with Jagmeet Singh's team to have him on.
Uh-huh.
We just couldn't figure out a date, unfortunately. And I understand they were going through an election, so I don't take that personally. I'd still love to have him on. There's a UFC fighter, Arjun Bhuler, who is out of Surrey, who flat out turned me down. He was very supportive and said, "Oh, this is great, but I'm not really his style."
Yeah,
which is fine. To be honest, and you've probably seen this. I mean, you've had 1,800 guests or 1,800 shows. People are pretty accessible in this city, and sometimes you just catch someone on a wrong schedule, and they're just too busy and they can't do it. But eventually, I think, especially as you build up an archive, people want to do it. People like, I mean, vanity is the devil's favorite sin. People love talking about themselves, as I'm demonstrating on your show right now.
It took me 6 years to get Quinn, so, you know.
I don't know if I have the stamina for that. You were a patient man, sir. I might give up if it's 6 years.
The way you do your interviews, I mean, because most of mine are done over the phone.
Right.
The first 6 years or so were all over the phone. That's why it's called On the Line.
Yeah.
And then I had one author insist on doing it in person. You do all yours in person?
They're all in person. I want to get Sam Cooper at some point, which might have to be over the phone.
Yeah.
I've talked to Nora Loretto about doing a podcast. I mean, she's not Vancouver or doesn't have a Vancouver connection, but I just want to talk to her.
Yeah, yeah.
So we might do that over the phone. You know, we'll see what happens. My worry is the audio quality and what it's going to sound like and whether you can do an over the phone for a full hour without grating the listener's ears.
Yeah, and I think, I find 40 minutes is or 45 minutes is maxing it on the phone. Because, you know, the person's tired holding the phone physically, you know what I mean?
It's different than being in conversation with someone. You see or you hear tonality, you see body language. It's much different.
But again, to you know, my experience, having done this for a while, over the phone, people will tell you things over the phone that they wouldn't tell you in person.
You think so?
That Don Imus used to say that when he had his radio show.
Really?
Yeah, it's a thing. You know, even if you're on book tour and you're in a hotel room, you're more comfortable. You're not looking at the other person's body language, and so you're
interesting.
You know, I'm talking to you right now. I'm looking at the clock. I'm looking at my notes. You know, it can be distracting for somebody. And I've noticed people sitting in front of me where that is distracting, and that is, you know,
when I look away, I'm thinking. By the way,
yeah.
I'm not distracted. Even though there are a lot of distractions in your studio,
it's a mess, isn't it?
It's not a mess. It's a beautiful museum. It's actually very orderly. Like I see the order in it. It's not that messy. It's pretty nice.
But, I do notice that people, when they're sitting in front of me and I start, you know, they think I'm bored, so they stop talking. And so that can be disconcerting for me as an interviewer because, they may have been in the middle of something totally interesting.
Yeah. See, intuitively, I would have thought it would be the other way. Because if you're on the phone, you're not seeing someone in person, you're not mirroring their body language, you're not reacting in that way. So I think on the phone, if I'm on a landline, I'll probably grab my cell phone and, like, go through some stuff.
Sure.
Might have a computer on. Like, I think I would be more easily distracted if I was just on the phone versus in person.
Yeah, I've talked to, with Sheila Rogers and Eleanor Wachtel, you know, the interviewers that I've always admired.
Mm-hmm.
And they've always said, over the – not over the – well, you know how the CBC works. You know, you could be in another studio.
Yes.
Something that they like better, say.
Where there's, like, glass between?
Not glass between them, but where they're separate. They're on the phone, if you will.
Yeah.
But
And maybe that's the difference between radio and what we're doing in terms of
podcasting. I think because you're in the mind of the listener themselves, or you're in the same position that the listener is in, both you and the guest, that you're
detached from the person you're talking to? I don't know. I mean, And I follow your logic.
Do one over the phone, and then we'll report back and we'll compare.
Yeah,
notes.
Yeah. I'll try to get Nora Loretto, or I'll try to get Ed the Sock or something over the phone. We'll try it. But yeah, intuitive. Like I follow your logic, and I see what you're saying, and it makes sense, and it might make sense for you and some other people. For me, I do like that interaction where you're in front of someone.
Yeah,
and I find that it's easier for me to adjust my mannerisms and my tone, even mid-interview sometimes, based on what the other person is giving me.
Yeah.
Sometimes if they're just naturally, you know, maybe a little quieter or lower energy, I'm trying to...
You can cue them, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to bring them up. So, not even cueing them, but just in the way I'm acting, or the way I'm interviewing. So... Yeah, I would disagree with you, but disagree with you only from my own personal experience.
Yeah,
you
do what works for you, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I find also that, because when you have these people in person, mm-hmm. you do have to block out the time, because I couldn't have, I could do 4 interviews in 2 hours.
Sure.
But I couldn't do 4 interviews in 2 hours, because then, some people arrive early, some people arrive late, and in the middle of one interview, I don't want someone, knocking at the door, right? Which I'm looking at the clock because someone's due in a few minutes.
But, okay, yeah, yeah.
But we're totally good. So it's that sort of that's what I hate about doing the show now is the logistical part of it and sort of mapping out my day and making sure that I have enough time to.
I'm impressed that you would do back-to-back interviews. I'm spent after.
It is tiring, isn't it? I've noticed physically.
Yeah, in a good way.
Yeah,
in a good way. I just couldn't, and it's rewarding. And I'm not saying
sure,
I'm spent like I'm. It's just. The thought of doing an interview and then going right into another one, I just know I wouldn't do that second one justice, and that's just me.
Did you do a lot of preparation beforehand?
Yeah.
Do you have notes like I do?
Yes.
Yeah.
I have to have notes because I'm afraid of completely going blank.
Right. Yeah. I'm the same way.
And I generally, it depends on the guest too. If I have a policymaker or a professional, and we're talking about something very serious and substantive, I do a ton of research.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, and it's one of those things that I think when people listen, they might only see they only see the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
But you have to do a lot of research in order to ask the right questions, as you're well aware. So I do a ton of research for those guests. For other guests that I've already been following their careers, or the subject matter is a little lighter, and I already have a little bit of background on it, a little less prep, but I absolutely prepare to every guest for me is a puzzle, and I just have to figure out how to solve that puzzle, because you can have a great guest, but if you haven't structured the interview properly or in the right way to fit that guest, it can be really boring.
Yeah,
even with a really good
sure,
guest.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's always a puzzle to try to bring out the best in my guest. And I hope I do that. Sometimes, maybe I don't do that to my own standards, but generally I enjoy that challenge, and I hope I deliver.
And you'll stop doing it when it's not fun, right? Because that's the excuse that I give people when they say, why have you done it for so long?
You've been having fun for 16 years, man.
Sometimes. Most of the time. I should say there are more parts of it that are enjoyable than are, less so.
But this part is the enjoyable part, right?
Yeah, because
interview, and I actually like the prep, too. It's all the technical stuff I hate.
Yeah. I mean, as you saw before we started, I couldn't figure out why I couldn't hear myself on my monitor here.
Yeah.
It's that sort of stuff. And the again, sitting with my calendar and planning it, making sure that I have some sort of life afterwards.
Right.
That's the pain.
That's
the
what
ass.
I'm doing wrong. My calendar, I basically have my work calendar, and then I have my podcast calendar. Maybe I need like a leisure calendar, and I should actually block out more time for yoga and leisure activities, so I make sure I can. Because it is, you work a full-time job as well. That work-life podcast balance is very difficult to calibrate.
Yeah.
And I've been struggling with that. I've probably put on like 20 pounds this year because I had an injury, so I really couldn't go to yoga and work out. And then I was busy with this, and getting back into routine was tough. So, yeah, no, I think that's a big challenge when you take on a project this size. But it could go with anything. It could go with if you're trying to write a book, you're going to be sacrificing time elsewhere. But I don't have kids, so I don't care.
I asked this of Cantlett, the wonderful Dina Del Bucchio.
Oh, I love Dina. And she's been on my show.
Yeah, Jen Suk Fung Lee, the marvelous podcast that they do. Why they don't do it more frequently.
Yeah.
And, you know, they obviously have very busy lives and the sort and other obligations that they can't do it as well. What are some of the things that prevent you from doing it as regularly as...
Yeah,
as you'd like, right? I'm assuming you'd like to do this every 5 times a week, if you will.
Yeah, if there was that much time and I didn't have to sleep, sure. I would absolutely do it. I think for me, and the first 26 episodes, so all throughout 2018, I was going weekly. And even when I went on vacation, I put some in the can and released them nevertheless, so I didn't skip a beat. This year, I have taken weeks off. And I find that the benefit to that is twofold. One, it allows me to relax a little bit, but then also I can commit more time to the guests. And it doesn't feel like I'm going back. Like I just said, I the idea of back-to-back would terrify me. But even just back-to-back weeks of being forced to do it because I have to put something out, too much. And I would rather really give each guest the preparation and the attention that they deserve.
This has been fun for me. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
This has been so much fun.
And I can't tell you how much I enjoyed talking about these things that we're all thinking about this week and reflect on this crazy thing that we do, podcasting. I appreciate you coming in.
Joseph, thanks. I have to say, it's an absolute honor. Thank you so much for having me. Like I said, what you've done is absolutely remarkable. I know your reputation is so high in this city, and thank you so much. It is really... touching to me that you would have me on.
Well, you were available. And I appreciate
also that. Also, I don't have kids, right? So it's
there
all
you
good.
Go. Yeah. At VanColor is the Twitter handle. This is vancolor.com is the website. Moamir, join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.